Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
It is one of the most gruesome crimes I've ever heard about, one of the most brutal crimes I've ever heard about. We're talking about a 15-year-old boy, Hector Hernandez Valdez, who back in June was stabbed to death. But the horrific nature of what we're talking about goes well beyond just kind of this, that curt, he was stabbed to death. He was stabbed 34 times, and finally his body was dumped in a bathtub, and his throat was then slit so that his accused killers could just watch him bleed out. There was apparently a video taken with one of the suspect's cell phones, which purportedly has the two people charged in this killing, taunting this 15-year-old as he died. The question, and the one of the teenagers, 16-year-old Cristobal or Luis Arroyo, 16 at the time, is charged in this. And his brother, who was 14 at the time, the decision needs to be made here as to whether or not he is going to be charged as a juvenile. So you got to go to court for that. You've got to have a hearing, and there's got to be a judge's decision. And going to court for that purpose is Pierce County Prosecuting Attorney Mark Lindquist, who joins me here on Newsline PM. How are you, Mark?
Good afternoon, Ken. Doing well, thanks.
I know you, and I know that these decisions are very difficult for you. What do you consider when you look at the possibility of charging a 14-year-old as an adult in a murder like this?
Well, this is unusual that we'd be asking the court to treat a 14-year-old as an adult, but we're taking this unusual step because it's an unusually brutal murder, and the more specific criteria we look at are the same the court will be considering, and that is, first, the seriousness of the crime, secondly, whether the crime was violent and premeditated, third, the strength of the case, fourth, are the juvenile's associates being treated as juveniles or adults? And then we also look at the sophistication, maturity of the juvenile, as the court does, and the record and history of the juvenile. And then the last factor that we look at and that I believe the court should give a lot of weight to is this: adequate protection of the community. Will the community be adequately protected if the juvenile's handled in the juvenile system? Or is this the type of crime and the type of the defendant that requires adult-style accountability? And to put that in some context, Ken, if this 14-year-old were to be treated as a juvenile, the maximum sentence would be 6 years. So he'd be released on his 21st birthday. That's the maximum sentence. The minimum sentence would be just 1 year. In 1 year, he could be out to an unsecure group home, that is, without locks on the door. And that decision to release him in 1 year would not be made by the judge or the prosecutor, but by an arm of DSHS. So when I look at this case, and I look at the crime, and as you talked about earlier, not only was he stabbed, you said 34 times, actually it was at least 34 times because the officers quit counting after 34 stab wounds were found. But in addition to that, there was a beating, there was clubbing, there was a slit throat. There was also, as you pointed out, the taunting and the swearing at the victim on the cell phone video. So when you look at this big picture and you apply the factors, it seems to me this is very much a case where the 14-year-old should be treated as an adult.
You know, it is so difficult to comprehend the level of violence associated with this crime, the brutality. And then talk about the people who are alleged to have committed the crime being 16 and 14 years of age. It's such a stretch to try to get your head around this. Let me ask you one of the other things that I'm curious of, Mark. Is there any consideration, even let's say for the sake of argument, that he's charged and tried as a juvenile, he gets a 6-year sentence, he doesn't get out for 6 years? Isn't there also some level of concern after a period of 6 years, even if he serves the full time, or, you know, as you mentioned, the possibility that he could be released earlier than that? But even after 6 years, you have to wonder, someone at that age who is so capable, if he's convicted, capable of doing something like that, I don't know if 6 years is enough of a buffer zone to turn a kid's life around.
Exactly. And that's one of the arguments we'll be making to the court under that factor of adequate protection for the community. His 16-year-old brother is facing 28 years or more. That is more in line with this type of murder. It doesn't make any sense that because his brother is 2 years older, his brother should be looking at 28, 30 years or more, and the younger one, the 14-year-old, could be walking out at 21. That doesn't seem safe for the community. It also doesn't seem fair and just and proportional.
See, and on the flip side of that, the idea that we're willing to give up any and all hope of rehabilitating the 14-year-old and instead treating him as an adult. Now, he would be kept at a juvenile detention center until what age?
Until 21 or so. At mm-hmm. some point between the ages of 18 and 21, he would head off to the adult prison system. But for the next few years, he would be in juvenile detention.
Because I don't know if you'll acknowledge this, but that's where you start to wrestle with the idea of, are we willing to give up on someone so young? And what you have to balance is the brutality of the crime that he's been charged with. And if convicted, you know, having shown that he did in fact commit this crime, that's just got to be an enormous burden to try to make that distinction, to give up.
No, you got that exactly right. It's that balancing test, and it's why it's so unusual, Ken, for us to be asking for a 14-year-old to be treated as an adult, because you don't, generally speaking, want to give up on a 14-year-old. The juvenile system is about rehabilitation, that is, getting kids back on the straight and narrow, helping them become useful members of the community. But this crime is, as we keep saying, so brutal, so gruesome, that I just can't see it being safe for the community for this defendant to walk out on his 21st birthday earlier.
That's just, like I said, it is such a difficult set of circumstances to wrap your head around this. It's almost inconceivable that someone so young can be accused of something so horrific. It's, you know.
Even police officers and prosecutors who see a lot of this were stunned by the brutality of this crime.
So when you go to court, because you need a judicial decision on whether or not he can be charged as an adult, what's the burden of proof on you to convince the judge that he should be?
The court will look at all the factors I mentioned earlier and weigh them and decide on what the court thinks is in the best interest of the community and the offender. It's not like a criminal case where we have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. This is a balancing test by the judge, where the judge will rely on those factors that I went through earlier, including, of course, that last factor of protection of the community.
All right, Mark Lindquist, Pierce County Prosecuting Attorney. Thank you very much. I appreciate the insight and the update that you've given us on this, Mark. Thanks.
Thank you, Ken.
All right, take care. That's one of these days. I would not. There's a lot of days I would not want to be in Mark Lindquist's shoes. This is certainly one of them. I'm tending to think the judge, what option is the judge going to have given the brutality of what this kid is charged with? I can't see him being charged as a juvenile. I really can't, but you never know.
This is Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
You would hope that they would have the professionalism, the knowledge base to deal with these things in a better manner. And I feel that the system failed them, and the DSH policy and procedures failed these children.
That's Chuck Cox reacting to a committee review that found some holes in the DSHS process as concerns Josh Powell and the death of his two little boys. I got to tell you, one of the things that just pissed me off, I can't say it any other way, is the Assistant Secretary for DSHS, Children's Administration, Denise Revels Robinson, said the recommendations provided by the committee, the results of which Chuck Knox has some issues with, will, quote, be of great help in our ongoing effort to improve our practice in keeping children safe. end quote. That particular statement just raised the hackles on the back of my neck, because DSHS, contrary to what the committee found, at least in my mind, is absolutely unequivocally culpable. They gave Josh Powell the means and the opportunity to kill his two little boys. They knew he was in the middle of the custody dispute. They knew he had been ordered to undergo an intensive psychosexual evaluation. They knew he was a suspect in his wife's disappearance. And there are so many things, and I'm not talking about the social workers, because I think the people on the street with those little kids, I think that they busted their butt to do everything for those two little boys. I'm not talking about the people who actually do the work. I'm talking about the policies, procedures, and regulations of DSHS. And there's a dead pile of bodies that lead to the door of that place down in Olympia. And somebody needs to clean that place up. That's all I'll say about that right now. Ann Bremner, Ann C.D. Bremner, represents the Cox family, joins me here on Newsline PM. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Ken. That was beautiful.
I don't know if it was beautiful. I'm just infuriated by this.
No, I just applaud you, and I read what you wrote earlier on your site, and you just it was so well stated. No one could have said it better.
Well, you represent the Cox family, and now they're going to have to resort to the possibility of a lawsuit. Where does everything stand right now in terms of what they're looking to do and how they're going to have to go about doing it?
Well, what they're looking to do is to file a notice of claim, and that'll be on Monday, which is, of course, a precursor to a suit. And you have to wait. There's a 60-day hiatus that has to be observed between the filing of a notice of claim and the filing of a lawsuit. What they're looking for is change. They've also been working on legislation to make sure this never happens again. I mean, when you think about it, just common sense dictates that if somebody is suspected in the disappearance of their wife or in her death, that they shouldn't see the kids. And then I could go on and on in terms of all the red flags that are in this case. But what Chuck and Judy want to see are policy changes, real changes, so that we don't have this pile of dead bodies like you talked about, you know, leading all the way down to Olympia. And the main thing we want to change is this focus, their stated focus, which is reunification of families at any cost, as opposed to looking out for the best interests of the child and the safety of the child. There's got to be a sea change.
So how do you accomplish that through a legal process? I mean, you can file the lawsuit, you can get a judgment, but it seems, I mean, there's been judgments that have been delivered against DSHS for decades here, and it seems it hasn't moved them off the dime yet.
No, and that's the thing, you know, and we know, Ken, I mean, it's not just anecdotally, we know in all these press accounts of like $10 million, $20 million, these huge verdicts and settlements against DSHS, going all the way back to the Eli Creekmore case, if people are, you know, old enough to remember that case, and nothing seems to change. So maybe it's not the money, maybe it is, it might make them change, but you can also come in and demand policy changes in a lawsuit and say, you've got to do something differently in the future, and maybe that's more important than money. Well, I think it is, you know, to make sure that you have... Why don't you cooperate with law enforcement? Why do you tell the cops you're going to put the kids in the house with him alone in a house with Paige, you know, after ordering a psychosexual evaluation? Like you said, they gave him the means and the opportunity to kill him.
Is this within the ability of DSHS, or is this something that has got to be addressed legislatively, do you think?
I think it's both. But DSHS, they can set their own policies. They can set their own procedures. I mean, you can't just go along, as I read the file, and just have this ongoing narrative without evaluating anything. It's just kind of like today we saw Josh saw the kids. Today there was a transfer to the grandparents without any real analysis. As red flags came and went, there was just no analysis about what was at stake, what could happen. What about 400 images of incest porn on Josh's computer? You know, what about the fact he took $3.5 million of life insurance out on his wife and kids? Common sense would have told anybody.
Something was up. Well, yeah. I got to tell you, if there's a legal way of forcing change, the Coxes could not have a better attorney at the helm. I'm serious, man. You go get him, man.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and C.D. Brander.
You're the best.
All right, stay with us.
Seattle's waking up to the Como Morning News 5 to 9. Right now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
So I'm looking at the Dow Jones average, just going through the roof. I mean, there's like, I think it's up over, well over 200 points. It's back up into 13,000 territory. And I was kind of chuckling to myself because as of yesterday afternoon, the Facebook shares, that I purchased were worth about 50% of what I had paid for them. Right. So I've lost half of the money that I invested in Facebook. And all I can do is hope that some of my other 401k stock explorations have buoyed me in another area. Then I'm reading this thing where Facebook has like 83 million fake accounts. I guess people have opened up accounts for their cats and their dogs and, you know, their African gray parrots, horses and mules, whatever. But and then there's people who sign up and actually they put false names in there because they just want to use it to log on to other places and they don't want people to really know who they are. So Facebook's trying to dig itself out of this and is going to start culling through there, and they're going to start shutting down some of these accounts. All of these people who put, you know, little kitty has his own Facebook account. I'm wondering if that's costing me money. I wonder if that's one of the reasons. I think it's just that Facebook isn't making the kind of money that people were hoping Facebook would make, particularly when it comes to smartphones and the like. Oh, well.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
This is an extraordinary record of failure. The president's policies have not worked because he thinks government makes America work. He's wrong.
That is a Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney putting his particular campaign spin on this jobless rate number that we got today. It's amazing. Some of this is just somewhat difficult to comprehend. The United States had 64,000 jobs added in June. In July, that bumped up to 163,000. Now that number was higher than really had been expected. But the problem is that the unemployment rate didn't reflect anything near that jump because the jump wasn't adequate enough. And so the unemployment rate actually rose from 8.2% to 8.3%, which is, I think, the tack that President Barack Obama took.
We've got more work to do on their behalf. Not only to reclaim all the jobs that were lost during the recession, but also to reclaim the kind of financial security that too many Americans have felt was slipping away from them for too long.
So we have the president touting the increase in the number of jobs that were added in July, and you have his opponent in the presidential race emphasizing the uptick in the unemployment rate by 0.1% there. And you know what I also find interesting? Because this, you know, the economy, it's a very complicated process. I wish it was as simple as either the Republicans or the Democratic Party thinks it is, the representatives from those parties, the politicians. But what I do find interesting is the subtleties. And sometimes you know, particularly during an election year, you don't often find subtleties in some of the messages. But Alan Krueger, who's a president of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, had a statement that I was reading where he said, you know, hey, it's critical we continue, dig our way out of the hole. And he went on to mention the recession that began in December 2007. And so, you know, the subtle message there is, hey, look, the people who are telling you they can fix it are the people who really kind of put everything into gear and are part of the reason that we're facing the difficulty that we're facing today. Patrick Rice is the economics reporter for Politico, joins me here on Newsline PM. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Do you agree with me that the subtlety of that, I found that somewhat refreshing at some level for some reason?
Well, I think that's been the Obama administration's message sort of throughout the economic turmoil, is that this is a mess they inherited rather than one they created. And certainly one that they're going to be pushing hard between now and November.
So what do you think the Fed, because I think the anticipation is that we're going to be looking for some more stimulus from the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I don't think today's number sways that one way or the other. It certainly wasn't low enough to trigger panic that we're headed back into a recession. It certainly wasn't high enough to convince everything that everything's fine, particularly not the, you know, the 5 million plus people who've been unemployed for more than 6 months straight. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this sways the Fed. But you know, my sense is that the today's report won't be a defining factor either way.
So what would be the defining factor, in your opinion? I mean, where do we have to get to before some additional action is taken then?
Well, I don't think the Fed looks at, you know, sort of specific one specific data point. I don't think there's a magic number of jobs, you know, over or under that would tip their decision. They look at a lot of different indicators. And the important thing to remember is that the Fed has a dual mandate. It's not only their job to bring us as close to full employment as possible. They're also supposed to control inflation. You know, inflation is minimal right now, and you know, there are several sort of investment indicators that suggest it's going to stay low for a long time. But they always have sort of one eye on employment, and then, you know, they're keeping the other eye on inflation and trying to make sure that over the long haul they're not setting us up for what's called an inflationary spiral.
Well, there are other factors that are going to be at play here in terms of what you refer to as the inflationary spiral, and I'll particularly point to the drought in much of the United States and how that is going to impact prices just up and down the consumer line. How do you gauge, you know, what is at fault by the economy and what is at fault, you know, with measures that are beyond our control, like the drought?
Well, I think if someone had that line, first of all, they'd be an extremely rich investor. And second of all, they'd probably be the most sought after economist in the country. You know, I think it's very difficult to sort of tease those two things out. I do think it's important to remember that inflation is minimal right now, because even though the Fed has been taking steps to sort of expand the amount of money out there, the money that the Fed is giving to banks in the hope that they're lending isn't all getting lent out. You know, there's this huge pool that what's known as excess reserves just sort of waiting, and so far people aren't able to borrow them or have decided not to out of lack of confidence that they can turn it into a profit.
See, and one of the other things that's puzzling is you keep hearing, I mean, you get some of the earnings reports from the major corporations and, you know, the department stores and supermarkets, you know, and the consumers out there spending a little bit more money than the consumer had been spending before. And yet there is this huge reluctance to kind of open the door a little bit wider and begin bringing people in to respond to what otherwise might look as kind of a, you know, some momentum in the economy. In terms of jobs.
You know, investing isn't part of a psychological question. You know, I think people are a little skittish. You know, we've been through sort of a shock to the system for younger people. You know, that they grew up in the 90s, which was an economic boom, and then, you know, they came out into the labor force in an economy that nothing about their youth had prepared them for. And I think that's sort of made people skittish, and it might scare off some investors from investing. I think the other piece is there's sort of a looming uncertainty about what federal policy is going to be on taxes and spending. You know, Democrats and Republicans are at an impasse over what's known as the fiscal cliff, which if we were to go over, would mean an increase in taxes and a contraction of government spending. And so if you're looking at decisions to invest and you have this event on the horizon that could, you know, sort of spark a recession, you may be a little hesitant to sort of put your chips in the middle of the table, knowing that, you know, there's a pretty bad hand that could be played.
And one of the other things that feels somewhat dismal, somewhat cynical, and I'm sure accurate, is that these numbers that came out with jobs growth, it's pretty much assumed that this is probably about as good as it's going to get. We're not going to see, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 jobs added in the month of July or August or September. We're pretty much stagnating at a level that really continues to keep the unemployment rate either, you know, ticking up a little or ticking down a little.
Well, I think that reflects a lot of underlying conditions. You know, it shouldn't be forgotten that that's, you know, one of the factors that got us into this mess was a housing bubble. And a bubble doesn't reflect real growth. It reflects sort of irrational confidence and what ultimately turn out to be bad bets. So as we look at the trajectory of the economy, I think the big question is, you know, are we only able to grow explosively through bubbles, or do we have a new engine of real growth coming up? And, you know, that's a question that has a lot of people nervous.
What do you think is the best indicator of that? Is it going to be the a turnaround in the real estate market, a definite turnaround in the job market? What would be the canary in the coal mine for that?
That's difficult to say. I think the thing about the real estate market is it has such a strong psychological effect. You know, if your home is underwater and you're facing losing your home, it's going to be real tough to justify sort of any sort of luxury purchase. And so that, you know, tends to lead people to spend really tightly, which then trickles over into the rest of the economy. And there's a theory that's getting pretty good play and seems to have some decent empirical support, is that the fallout from a housing bubble is worse than, you know, some like the fallout from like the dot-com bubble or something like that, because people's homes is so tied up in their consumer psychology.
All right. Patrick Rice, economics reporter with Politico. Thanks for lending us your expertise. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Good talking with you.
Yeah.
I wish, you know, there's got to be, because there's so many mysteries here. And, you know, I think it's going to take someone a lot smarter than me to figure out, you know, and Patrick, how it's all going to shake out in the end.
Reporting the news, understanding the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
If I'm voting for free speech, if you will, I support gays, but I also support the right to do business.
That was a Chick-fil-A customer in Chicago on Wednesday participating in Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. This was the brainchild of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. And, you know, here's the background again, in case you're not familiar with it. Chick-fil-A, family-operated chain of fast food places that primarily are... It's based in Atlanta, so they're primarily in the South, but they have branched out. There's some in Chicago. Jeremy was telling me that there's actually a Chick-fil-A franchise up at Western Washington University, which I was totally unaware of and certainly haven't heard anything about it. Anyway, the CEO of Chick-fil-A has been very, very vocal about his opposition to marriage equality. And it's not just his vocal opposition. He's channeled millions of dollars into organizations that are fighting against marriage equality. And so then you had these pandering politicians. They're the ones that screwed everything up, because there had been talk among the gay community and supporters of marriage equality about, you know, perhaps boycotting Chick-fil-A in protest of, you know, that this being a source of revenue for someone who's trying to keep marriage equality from happening. Then the politicians get in. You know, we have this joker in Chicago, this alderman, who says, well, they were going to come into my district. I'm not going to let them. I'm going to use the power of my office to keep them from setting their business up. And that just ticked a lot of people off. And in fact, my commentary, I don't believe in the power of government punishing people for political differences in political beliefs. I'll support the boycott, but I'm not supporting, you know, government punishing somebody as a business owner by keeping them out and operating their business. And it's interesting to me, because the one guy that we heard off the top here in Chicago saying, hey, I support gays, but I also support the legitimacy of a business to operate where it wants. So I'm wondering, because I got to tell you, in all truthfulness, this Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day on Wednesday was hugely successful.
I would proudly go for some waffle fries and a jumbo size sweet tea. And I won't forget the chickens who died, who gave their life for me. So I grab this sandwich, take a bite, put it back down on the tray.
Yeah, there, like I said, a lot of people. There were people who were waiting in line for over an hour, in order to show their support on Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. And we're talking at, you know, just about every one of the locations. They have something like 1,400 locations or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so now in response to that, now we've got activists who have set today as National Same Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A. National Same Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A. And as part of what they're doing, they're encouraging couples to go to Chick-fil-A and to take a picture or a video of themselves kissing. I have, to be real honest with you, I think this is kind of a weak-kneed response. I think the prospect of failure here is significant. And it bothers me that it was so successful on Wednesday that what this demonstration, or perhaps lack thereof, is going to do is kind of, it's going to kind of undermine the whole purpose of what really began the controversy and the discussion and the pandering politicians, and that is why people should legitimately support marriage equality. So I don't want the message to get lost in this tomfoolery. And I hope I'm wrong. I honestly hope I'm wrong. But I have a very strong suspicion that this National Same Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A is not going to be anywhere near as successful as the Appreciation Day that took place on Wednesday. And again, I'm going to rationalize, at least in my mind, I'm going to say that the Appreciation Day included people who support marriage equality, but just were very uncomfortable with the idea of using government to punish somebody for holding a different opinion. So, like I said, I hope I'm wrong about the Same Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A today. I guess we'll find out more, you know, in the next day or two. We'll see exactly how successful it was.
What happens next happens on the Como Afternoon News today at 3. Now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Still kind of reeling with what the aftermath is going to be in the wake of those Aurora, Colorado movie shootings 2 weeks ago today. Ashley Moser. Ashley Moser is the woman who lost her six-year-old daughter. Her six-year-old daughter was killed. While she was hospitalized, she has suffered a miscarriage. She is likely going to be paralyzed for the rest of her life. She's going to have all of this mental and physical trauma that's going to lead to just, I mean, her whole life is going to be made up of medical costs. And I was reading some of the particulars. Caring for a gunshot victim who's hospitalized for up to 7 days, that's going to be like about $56,000. Rehabilitation, if you're at a rehabilitation facility, that can be up to like $250,000 a year. You got a psychiatrist that charges $400 an hour, medications, you know, a couple of $100 a month. And I want to remind people that the Aurora Victim Fund has raised money, is in the process of continuing to raise money, and that there are more 10 nonprofits that have set up donation pages. And by the way, Ashley Moser still has a bullet lodged in her neck. Boy, I feel for those victims. And we need to not forget what they're going through and what we might be able to do as a broader community to kind of ease what is happening to them and their families. Because this, for them, is not going to be over for a very, very long time.